Zoom in on global affairs with insightful debates and exclusive interviews. This is World Insight.
Hello and welcome to World Insight with me, Tian Wei. Singapore Prime Minister Lee Hsien Loong will step down on May the 15th, ending a two-decade rule. Deputy Prime Minister Lawrence Wong is set to take over, a key move in the country's long-planned leadership transition from the third generation to the fourth generation. Lee Hsien Loong is one of the longest-serving current political leaders in the world. His father, the late Lee Kuan Yew, served as Singapore's first prime minister. As the leadership transition happens at a time of sluggish global economic growth and rising living costs, how could Singapore's fourth-generation political leadership steer the economy? What does the leadership transition mean for Singapore and beyond? To answer those questions, let's talk to our panelists today. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. According to the latest news, the handover of the prime ministership will be starting from May the 15th. Of course, we all saw the message coming from Prime Minister Lee talking about his handover. Now, from Singapore, our two guests, Dr. Tan first, Kiwi, tell me more about your thoughts on this handover.
This is we've been preparing for this for maybe the past 2 years. So this is not big news. And of course, those of us who live in here, they know that all this preparation, they are very meticulous in selecting the right leader. Mm. So actually, we don't expect a lot of many major changes. It's not like, let's say, in another country, a new party comes in and they have new policy, then you expect new changes. But this Mr. Lawrence Wong is from the same party. He's been nurtured and groomed by the same party. So I'm sure he embraced all the policies and philosophies of the same party. So we don't expect a lot of changes. I mean, of course, everyone is different. So of course, he will have some difference. But I don't think there's going to be any major shock.
Eugene, continuity, that's pretty much the key word.
Yes, I think Dr. Kiwi Tan, got it right. It's very much, change amid continuity. And I think that's something that, the Singapore political leadership has always prided itself. Mm. The consistency in policy, across time, across generations. Of course, with the necessary adaptations, to take into account how society is changing. Right. But yes, this has been much anticipated. I think it brings to an end the uncertainty, that had dogged the transition, earlier on. So I think it's something that Singaporeans are looking forward to. A new leadership, offer the prospect of new policies.
Over the past few years, Singapore, together with others around the world, went through tremendous challenges, economy, pandemic, and the list goes on. But today, in retrospect, what do you think, Kiwi, Prime Minister Lee, do right?
Well, I think what he has done right is to select the right person. I mean, I think you mean the COVID disruption. Okay, that was, of course, unexpected. He was supposed to sort of hand over much earlier, but because of the COVID pandemic, he decided to stay on until it's over. And now that it's safely behind us, that's when he decided to hand over. But if you look at his record, I'm an economist, and from an economic point of view, the record of the past 20 years is very good. Everything has gone up, almost everything. So, if we just look at just economic figures alone, you really can't complain over what he has achieved in the past 20 years.
The pandemic was certainly a test. To you, Eugene, what do you think he did right over the past few years when every leadership of politics was trying to struggle about, what to do?
Well, I would say that, Prime Minister Lee, was able to rally, the country behind, the difficult measures, that were put in place to curb the spread of COVID-19. And I think there was also, the significant efforts put in to ensure that businesses, particularly, in key industries, such as civil aviation, were able to maintain, sufficient staff numbers. Because I think, the government was very mindful that even as they sought to deal with the immediate concerns of the pandemic, they also had to plan, for the future. right? And the concern was, you know, whether we would be able to get back to business as quickly as possible, you know, once the pandemic is over. So I would say that, you know, being able to get the country behind the difficult measures, you know, putting in place the necessary financial resources and help for businesses, I think those were important, you know, in helping Singapore, you know, move very quickly, you know, to a post-pandemic normal. Right.
Mr. Rong, of course, Singapore during the years of the pandemic, especially after, right after it, has become such an attractive destination for world capital and talents, including business leaders from Asia and elsewhere. So there must be something that Singapore did right, and certainly that has a lot to do with the leadership of Prime Minister Lee.
Yeah, that's exactly the reasons why I think people around the world, and China included, that while this transition, this leadership succession has long been anticipated, we are also following with great interest. Well, and also, of course, would like to pay our great respect to Prime Minister Lee and good wishes for Prime Minister Wong. As for the success and achievements of Singapore that has been made, both in either in terms of achieving stability, prosperity, and also attracting and making itself attracting place for business, for investment, I think there's, of course, reasons for that. And China, in the past decades, particularly since I think the opening up and establishing diplomatic relations, has always been working closely with Singapore, learning from each other, and in the sense that China and Singapore can develop together, play a role, I think, that kind of factor of stability and certainty in this region.
Though Singapore, geographically speaking, is a relatively a small country, the role it plays here in the region, in Asia and beyond, is much more than its geography, both in terms of international relations and also in Singapore's traditional traditions with China, particularly during some critical junctures of China's contemporary history. So Eugene, Lawrence Wong is of the so-called 4G, the fourth generation of Singaporean leaders. Of course, he has been very experienced both as the Deputy Prime Minister and also as the Finance Minister. To you, what this generation of leaders need to learn in order to have Singapore as significant as it is today to the rest of the world, while at the same time playing a constructive role in the region and beyond?
I think what's really essential, you know, for the fourth generation leadership led by, you know, Mr. Lawrence Wong, you know, would be to ensure that Singapore continues, you know, to be relevant to the world, because relevance is important for Singapore to survive. You know, it means that, you know, we have a role to play. So that means, you know, being nimble, being ahead of the curve when it comes to looking at, you know, the new economic opportunities, and increasingly, you know, playing our part, you know, in the international community. I think, you know, as Singapore progresses, you know, there will be greater expectations, you know, for Singapore, you know, to contribute to regional peace and stability. We have always been doing that, but I think, you know, the next generation of leaders are very mindful, you know, that it is important, you know, for a small country like Singapore, you know, to have its voice heard and to play, you know, a constructive role, you know, in international politics, you know, particularly, you know, with concerns over, you know, great power rivalry, you know, in Southeast Asia. And I think, you know, the leadership will be very focused, you know, on ensuring, you know, that Singapore can play, you know, that constructive role in furthering peace and prosperity.
Kiwi, your thoughts on the same question?
Well, we try to remain relevant, but you must understand, since we started, let's say in 1959, we were more the most prosperous economy within ASEAN. So of course we had good leaders, so we stand out. But now, in the past 5 to 10 years, all our neighbors are growing rich as well. So the danger is that, you know, if, let's say Indonesia or any country in Vietnam, they grow bigger, prosperous, we will become smaller. So I suppose if we want to play a role, we must try to keep on maintaining our prosperity so that we can continue to contribute. Because once our prosperity goes and other neighbors overtake us, then people will tend to maybe think twice about listening to us. Mm. That's the challenge.
And the other thing, of course, is about the U.S.-China relations. Singapore has always been playing a bridging role, to put it very politely, between China and the United States, being a good listener while being a constructive partner in trying to bring peace and stability between the two countries. So, of course, now things are changing very fast, and the factors that are having an impact on this are also moving. So, Kiwi, your thoughts on that? Singapore's role.
Well, I mean, our leaders in the past have been very successful to navigate this, because basically, I mean, we are a really small player between really two big elephants, and China is getting to be even a bigger and bigger elephant as year progress. So we have to play to be peaceful to both parties, because we are really a small end compared to the big economies. So hopefully all the previous leaders have done that, and our next, the Lawrence Wong and the rest of the years to come, will continue to do it. Because if not, then we'll be irrelevant.
Right.
And I'm confident that they can do it.
This year is a very eventful year, to say the least. Half the world's population going to the polls to elect their leaders, including in the United States, which the result will be announced later in November. So certainly the change of personnel in terms of prime ministership in Singapore, almost half a year before that. So Mr. Rong, tell me more about your thoughts on both the timing, the significance of timings of this, and also what you see the role of Singapore could still remain to be. Your colleagues just saying China is getting ever bigger.
I clearly remember that Singapore Prime Minister Lee, when it is needed, then it would not hesitate to speak up. As far I remember, I think he wrote a very interesting article published on foreign affairs and others. He would use various kind of platform in various ways to express Singaporeans' views, which I think now is much needed in this region and this world. And certainly, I think the region as a whole, and China included, would like to continue to see that Singapore to play such right role. The most important for me as a sort of scholar is ideas. Skill matters, but ideas matters more. Mm-hmm. And in this fast changing and uncertain world, Singapore, despite the size, it can and should, and it's expected to continue to play an important role in this regard. On the question of right and wrong, on the question related to peace, stability, and the prosperity of this region and the world as a whole.
Well, we're going to see how that role is likely to proceed for Singapore. I'm sure there will be voices from all sides asking Singapore to be having the right ideas. Having said that, though, my last question regarding the Singapore economy and also the immigration issue, those have always been a difficult one for Singapore. Now, for our two Singaporean colleagues, your thoughts on what might be the major challenges and could be the solutions already in sight on these issues for the new prime minister? Eugene?
Well, I think in terms of immigration, there is the need to take a balanced approach. I think Singapore will always remain an immigrant society given our low domestic birth rates. And the economy is growing, so we need a variety of talent, not just in terms of quantity, but in terms of quality as well. So the challenge is, to make immigration policies work for Singapore, right? And that means, ensuring Singaporeans that talented people who come in, will not result in Singaporeans being worse off. I think where the economy is concerned, I think there is the need to continue to be creative, to be able to be ahead of the curve, whether that means in investing in new technologies, in going to growth areas, such as green technologies. So I think that's something which, the leadership under Mr. Lawrence Wong, will keep a very close eye on. We always have to be one step ahead. I think that's the fate, for a small country like Singapore.
Kiwi and Eugene, as well as Rongying. Thank you so much for the three of you joining our discussion. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Beyond the headlines, this is World Insight.
Welcome back. This is World Insight. I'm Tianwei. How to understand a country, a people, a civilization? Well, that's a huge topic. But Willy Sieg, the world's largest collector of contemporary Chinese art, has figured out his ways. First as a journalist, then a businessman, after that, a Swiss ambassador to China. And the list goes on. No matter what his official titles are, he has made his way to the heart of China. Definitely not through hearsay or theirsay, but through the art of the Chinese. He has donated a huge chunk of his contemporary Chinese art collection to the then-to-be-built M-Plus Museum in Hong Kong. By the way, the museum now has become a signature component of Hong Kong's West Kowloon Cultural District. Dr. Sieg is continuing his journey with Chinese contemporary art and help others also feel the pulse of the real China. After supporting the most prominent presence of contemporary Chinese art at Venice Biennale in 1999, he has remained enthusiastic about connecting ever more Chinese artists to the world stage. Take a look at my latest interview with him. You know, back in the 1980s and 90s, there were back and forth in China's relationship with the rest of the world. You were there, into China as often as you can, and also stay with the Chinese artists. Then, when China joined the WTO and really connected with the rest of the world, you were also there, you know, trying to witness every step of the way the changes. And now we are seeing another interesting period of time in which people are trying to rediscover China, if I could use a very diplomatic word. And you are still here. So I guess, how do you make process and observe and try to digest and be able to come up with your own way?
Once I was into it, there was no way out. And of course, it all connected to my professional life, to my private life. So, well, once you are in it, you know, then how other than to go forward and, well, master whatever, you know, the situation would, demand. So that curiosity I also have just helped me through every single issue. Of course, now I'm much more sophisticated in observing China, and China has become much more sophisticated than it was end of the 70s. And so, you know, both sides kind of learned how to cope with the world and with the other part of the world. So yes, that particularly art helps me to remain involved in whatever happens in China. I think very early it will be visual in art.
If I could quote an artist who just won the 2023 SIG Prize, a prize that you have been supporting in order to encourage more development of Chinese contemporary art, this artist said this in an interview. It was about my personal interest. And then I found out more about how society works. And you just want to try to solve some problems. Maybe it's something you are doing in vain. It's not something you can really solve. But during this process, you get to know yourself more and you get to know your surroundings more. And he continues to say, you want to criticize, you want to reflect, and you want to be an inspiration for others because you always gain inspiration from others. End of quote. A reflection about what went through his mind when he was trying to create art. Of course, he belongs to the younger generation, the latest generation of Chinese artists. So when you were saying they are very different, how do you see, you know, words like these coming from the younger generation?
Well, I see these remarks more as observations by a young individual getting into producing art. And I created actually this art award for very much that purpose he's describing, to have a relevant debate maybe in society about contemporary art, what art should do in a society and all that. So that's what art is very much about.
And what have you seen in the latest works of these winners of the prize? Many works that impressed you?
The artist, a female artist, worked with AI, and using machine learning, but say impacting the mechanism of the learning itself. So a gaming engine being impacted by another AI engine. So, you know, adding more layers to art creation than one could do earlier. So that was quite experimental.
Now, these days, the West Kowloon Cultural District has become a well-known place for the rest of Asia and the world to see art related to China and from China. But back then, when you were making the decision to make a donation, there was nothing there 8 years ago. And there were ups and downs in the debates about whether there should be one place like that, how much funding it needed, and what M Plus it should be about. And the list goes on. Can you share with us what you went through? And now, when you reflect upon your decision to donate a huge chunk, thousands of work to the M Plus in Hong Kong, after decades of collecting Chinese contemporary art, what comes to your mind?
Well, first of all, I'm very happy to see it in this great M Plus Museum in Hong Kong. And I think it's the best museum in the world at the moment, and it better be, because it's the newest, most recent, best architects, and the people of Hong Kong put a huge fund there to build it. So it's a great home for that part of my collection. And when I started the collection, and I noticed no one really collects in other than random way, I thought I want to build this collection which allows to read the storyline of contemporary art from its inception to today and find a home in China. Because to me it was clear, even though there was interest in London, New York, etc., it must be in China to be available to the Chinese people. Hong Kong is China, so I'm quite happy about the outcome.
You have been, together with your wife, Rita, very welcoming to many visitors from China to your home. And whoever wants to know China, they want to visit your home, get to know China through your art and also talking to you. I really wonder how big a heart you and your family need to have in order to embrace all of these people with curiosity, with enthusiasm, and sometimes with frustrations.
Of course, it's rewarding for both sides, because for us also very interesting to see what the reactions are, be it of Chinese people coming from foreigners, coming from officials from China, coming of private collectors from China. You know, it's a diversity of reactions. Also in the exhibition here in Hong Kong, for me, this is a very moving moment. Sometime I lead the tour through the exhibits, and very often the people start to cry, the Chinese people, mainland people, they start to cry. I'm very moved. They say, well, I have no idea. This is, you know, we have this width and depth of art creation in China. Others, particularly moved, say, oh, I see my whole life mirrored in this art. I didn't know this exists. So, you know, I see my youth, I see my upbringing reflected in this art. So it's a very rewarding process, as it appears for both sides.
Some say, despite the efforts that we have been making, the communications between the East and West, especially at a time when you see the quote-unquote the paradigm change, still remains skin deep, particularly with the test of the pandemic and things related to it. How do you see that as someone who has been so keen in bringing the Chinese contemporary art to the world and learning through it about China?
Well, there were, shall we say, better moments on both sides than right now, but I'm very optimistic. And I think art can also cure some of the issues and can open, you know, the eyes of either side. So will it go beyond skin deep? That's a long-term issue. But I think the West has realized that globally there is a culture, the Chinese culture, that is a match to the Western culture. And it starts to realize it may have to acquire more knowledge about that. And China makes an effort, although I think that that effort could still be made better on the Chinese side as well, to communicate what Chinese culture is about. So it takes a long time to get that each side, you know, will develop a full understanding. But it may happen.
And that's all the time we have for today. I'm Tian Wei. On behalf of the team, thanks for being with us. Bye for now.